This is New England Public Radio's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Tom Reaney, host of Jazz on the Mode at New England Public Radio. And I'm speaking this morning with Jeff Muldaur. Today is Friday, September 15th, and our conversation is taking place a day before Jeff's appearance at the Parlor Room in Northampton. So good morning, Jeff, and a pleasure to speak with you today.
Good morning. Do you hear those crickets?
Are those crickets or English muffins?
Well, there'll be both in this conversation.
I'm not picking up on the crickets at the moment.
Okay, good.
All right.
But they're happening.
Okay. You're playing Pomfret, Connecticut tonight, Northampton, Massachusetts tomorrow night. Solo shows, what should we anticipate when we see you tomorrow
solo
night?
Solo shows. I'm sneaking out on weekends. I'm now living in the Hudson Valley near Woodstock.
Oh.
Back where I caused so much trouble. And, it's wonderful. So I can take these little jaunts, and I'm really, you know, still involved in a project in Amsterdam that's been going on for 8 years. So that's my main focus now.
And what is that?
Oh, it's my secret weapon. I've been creating an album, two albums, and a documentary with members of the Netherlands Philharmonic and the Dutch Radio Orchestra. And I put together chamber ensembles and write music and arrange music. And so it's been very educational for me, and some of the music might be pretty good. I don't know. It's up to you guys.
Well, speaking of chamber ensembles and your beautiful work as an orchestrator, last night in Jazz on the Mode, I featured your album Private Astronomy, A Vision of the Music of Big Spiderbeck. Such a beautiful album. I loved it when it came in over a decade ago, and it was nice to have a good excuse to play it again last night for Jazz on the Mode listeners. That seemed to be quite a different undertaking for you in 2003 vis-a-vis what I knew of your music from the preceding 40-odd years. What was it that that brought you to Big Spiderbeck's music and that album of his piano pieces?
Well, Bix came first. He came before all the other stuff I learned that you heard first. You know, when I was a little kid, I grew up on my brother's jazz 78s and 10-inch LPs. And so that's the stuff that's in my bones. You know, then I heard Lead Belly and, you know, Blind Willie Johnson and things like that. And I sort of went, what is that stuff? And, you know, 50 or 60 years later, that was sort of where I went to. But as Bix's 100th anniversary of his birth and came up, and I had messed around with these chamber arrangements of his piano pieces over the years, and quite frankly, people couldn't play them. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty discouraged until I got with Dick Kinnett in New York, and we put together ensembles, and they did okay, but we could never find a trumpet player that could handle it, even some of the best in town. And then all of a sudden, this guy Mark Gould showed up, and that changed everything. Showed up with a C cornet, and he was the principal trumpeter for the Metropolitan Opera. So he had chops to spare, and he could play my charts, and I went, phew, I knew this stuff could be played. So, and then the lucky thing was Joe Boyd got us on Deutsche Grammophon. So for a little while, I was on the same label as Beethoven. You know, that's good.
Yeah. That was a surprise in itself to open the package.
That was
back
wonderful.
Then at 03,
I love those people in Hamburg, and right. You know, they should the German government should have taken Deutsche Grammophon and nationalized it. Mm. They got sold to those people at Universal, whoever those gangsters are. And so it's too bad that, you know, 2/3 of the greatest music ever recorded is owned by a corporation. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I think it should have been nationalized. Maybe it will be someday.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was great to be on Deutsche Grammophon, and great that everybody enjoyed the album. And I really did get done what I wanted to get done, you know, is do a chamber arrangements of his piano pieces. And I had never heard anybody in my mind successfully do that. I just didn't like other people's takes on it. Just plain and simple. I went, man, somebody's got to do it this way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why I did it.
Now, if I understand your chronology, you spent some time at Berklee in the late 60s or so?
I just took private lessons there, which was important for me. I didn't learn a whole lot. But I learned that what I learned about what I already knew, and how to put a label on it. Those times in Cambridge were a little more theory oriented than people would think. You know, we were playing folk music and this and that, but with the junk band, there were a lot of different changes, a lot of stuff, and there were also jazz guys around, and they'd show up at parties, and we'd learn all those chords, and we'd talk numbers, and you know, the three chord and the flat nines and rah, 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 and all that stuff. And going over to get these lessons at Berklee, I just sort of started to learn the language, which was good for me, so I could start relating to other people with notes, because I had never done that before. I'd just been in the jug band, and we just barked out ideas, you know. So that was a beginning of transitioning after the jug band to becoming more legitimate in my approach.
Your album title for the Bix Centennial Project was Private Astronomy, which is a beautiful phrase from Ralph Burton's book, Remembering Bix. Your own liner note essay for that album begins, "When one is young and keen, the finest features of our world come to the senses with ease." I love that line, Jeff. And while I know that we're all young once, we're not all keen. We're not all keen.
When we look back, we were relatively keener than now, I would assume. So
yeah, that's what I'm inferring. Yeah. But what do you you know? Do you have a particular sense of where your keenness came from?
Nope. You know, my mother could sing beautifully, sing me to sleep. You know, I just had that thing where my ears were good, and you know, and my brother's record collection just educated me beyond comprehension, my comprehension anyway, when you're listening to Louis Armstrong and, you know, Bessie Smith and Duke Ellington, you're starting to hear, especially with Duke and this and that, you know, intervals and clusters and things are in my bones, so they don't throw me. I hear them, you know. So I'm lucky there. I had that wonderful education in my brother's room. When I was growing up, music was a much more communal thing. And it was also a time when roots, or more roots type music and more regional kind of music was all of a sudden breaking out of its chains through the highly controlled record market. And all of a sudden, Fats Domino starts showing up, you know, mm-hmm. and Chuck Berry and things like this. And all of a sudden, we got to hear this music from around the country. So that, in addition to the sort of doo-wop thing, which really comes out of gospel music, and mm-hmm. you know, the doo-wop thing was everywhere. It was in the locker rooms when you were in a track meet. These guys would sing doo-wop, you know. And so music was more everywhere, even in church. I loved that music, man, when I went to church.
You know my soul. Look back and wonder.
Well, you grew up in, was it Westchester County?
Yep.
How did you get to Cambridge?
By doing poorly in prep school.
Ah.
In other words, if I had done better, I would have gone somewhere else. But it was the luckiest thing that ever happened, because it was the first time I ever ran into people that, you know, had the same type of love for certain types of music that I had. And just one thing led to another from that place. It was easy, you know. I also spent some time down in New Orleans when I left BU the first time. And that was educational as well. Of course, that's where my first gigs were.
Really?
Rampart Street. Yeah, mm-hmm. 62. Mm-hmm. 61, 62.
So you're like, 18, 19 years old at the time?
18, yeah.
18, yeah. What was New Orleans like in the early 60s? I understand it was a profoundly different place before the JFK assassination.
Well, this is we don't have enough time to go into this, but it was way different than it was after the assassination and quite frankly, after the election of Jim Garrison, who almost single-handedly killed the town.
Yeah.
That's when all the guys went to L.A., and they were leaving that place like rats off a ship, because they were busting everybody, they were shutting down little bars, and so I was there before then. So it was much more like what it was for Tennessee Williams when he went there. You know, mm-hmm. it was this gorgeously open and wonderful and beautiful and musical town, and you know, the music was everywhere and it was on the streets, and I got to hear my heroes at Preservation Hall and go over to hear poets with jazz backing and go over to hear R&B, and, you know, it was just incredible.
Now, were the poets, I'm familiar with, like, Maple Street Books in New Orleans. Walker Percy, I think, was familiar with that place. Is that, are you talking about a place like that?
No, I'm talking more like a hip beat thing, like they would have in North Beach, San Francisco. There were guys like, there was a guy named Bruce Lippincott used to back these guys up on the sax.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like beat poets.
Okay, yep. Rex Roth.
People don't think of New Orleans that way, but
in
that period, all this stuff was going on at once, you know? So it was pretty good down there, man. And then I got back up to Boston and got a little job in the hospital until the jug band formed. And then that was the beginning of my full-time musical life. And Eric Von Schmidt was up there, and Questkin and Fritz Richmond and all these great people, and Bill Keith and Jim Rooney, and it was just pretty nice, man.
Back to New Orleans for just a moment. You're going there at the age of 18. Was that a common kind of sojourn for kids? No. Okay.
No.
But did you go there in search of the roots, as it were?
No, in search of, probably part of it is I knew a guy who was in school there in Tulane.
Okay. Yep.
But we never saw each other. I took a little place in the French Quarter, and that was it for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see George Lewis and Jim Robinson and Alcide's Slow Drag Papa Show and all these great guys I had heard in my brother's bedroom.
Right.
And they were old, but they were playing at Preservation Hall, and I just sat at their feet every night, just in awe, you know. And Clarence Frogman Henry was playing on the corner of St. Peter and every night at a piano bar. And there was great, you know, inexpensive eating places that the musicians used to go to. Buster's was incredibly famous. You know, you'd sit next to guys who played in street bands, you know, and marching bands, the Tuxedo Brass Band or the Onward Brass Band, and they're in their uniforms, and you're eating gumbo next to them, you know.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. Fond memories.
Now, was it during that period in New Orleans where you ventured out to find Blind Lemon's gravestone?
Yeah.
What was that?
But I didn't get there on that trip.
Ah, what happened?
I visited later. I did it later. But it was quite a story. And it was pretty risky, really. It was a little stupid.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, you have a little hair, a little longer than other people. Down in Louisiana now, every cracker down there has hair to their butt, you know.
Right.
But in those days, if you had hair just Ringo style, you were dead meat,
right.
You know?
Right.
So it was I ended up in jail and everything, but I'm glad I did it. I wish I knew Bobby Charles then, because he lived in Lafayette.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or near Lafayette, Abbeville probably then.
Uh-huh. Well, the Sojourn, the Odyssey, kind of inspired your song, Gotta Find Blind Lemon, in which you recount this and... In fairly picaresque detail, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I only have one warning to your listeners, and that is if you spend the night in Lafayette jail, do not eat the pork. All right? That was a mistake.
Oh, man. I only remember bologna between two pieces of white bread.
Hey, that's safe.
No mayo, no mustard.
With my broom in my hand, headed out from Jackson Square. With my broom in my hand, headed out from Jackson Square. I had to get to East Texas, find that graveyard somewhere. Well, now down Highway 90, night fell on Lafayette. Well, down Highway 90, night fell on Lafayette. I had just a dime in my pocket, I was hungry and soaking wet.
Joe Boyd's book recounts an early experience that I think the two of you shared in finding Lonnie Johnson in Philadelphia and sort of piecing together enough green to present him in a concert. What was that about?
Oh, it was a house concert, yeah, a house party at Murray Kempton's house.
Yeah, in Princeton?
Yeah.
Wow, small world. Did you know Murray Kempton or his family?
No, they did. They did.
Who's they?
The Boyds.
Oh, I see.
Joe okay. Boyd and his brother Warwick.
Okay. Wow.
And we found Lonnie in the, I guess Joe or somebody had heard about him being in Philadelphia on the radio. And then we looked him up in the phone book. There were three Lonnie Johnsons. we called and we got him.
Did you get him on number one?
No. I always say I got him on number three just to make it dramatic, but I don't really remember.
Right, right. And he was really kind of inactive at the time.
That's right.
Yeah, was
and
he became
fairly active from then on, which is really nice. And he made a couple of albums, and I'd see him at Gertie's Folk City, and he ended up in Toronto, I think.
Mm. I know he did
and
those American.
He was just a beautiful man. So much talent, and he was the biggest star they had, man, in the 40s.
Yeah.
He was the biggest blues star. He was B.B. King's hero.
Right, yeah.
You know, and this is a guy who was missed in the, not in England, but in the United States in the great, you know, white revival of black blues music.
Yep.
They basically went to the Delta stuff,
sure,
which is great and all that. But, you know, no Lonnie Johnson, no Leroy Carr, no the real stars.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah.
And fortunately, the jug band hit on some of that, and I hit on some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was an amazing man. Played with Louis Armstrong. He played with Duke Ellington. And he was also the biggest blues star. So,
yeah. Victoria Spivey and so many others. Yeah.
He's an example of, you know, I said to myself, oh, man, I want to be like these guys. And then you look at a guy who's washing dishes in a hotel who was the biggest star.
Yeah.
And you go, well, maybe I only half want to be like these guys, you know.
Sure.
Maybe we'll just go for the music.
He made those American Folk Blues Fest tours of Europe on a few of the years they went over. And And there's a beautiful moment, I don't know if you've seen it, where Sonny Boy Williamson introduces him.
Yeah.
And calls him a great musicianer and a fine gentleman. And Lonnie comes out.
Well, you know, it's the same thing like when we did that album with Sippy Wallace, we got Otis Spann in on that.
Mm.
And when he was in the room with Sippy Wallace, he was in the room with a queen in his eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I mean, he didn't want anybody near her. It was like he was protective.
Yeah.
You know, get out of the room. We got to just let us two, you know, because, you know. Get her something she needs, you know.
Right.
She was just a, you know, a god to him, a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is, I make note of these things, so I have my own history, you know.
Sure.
And Lonnie was one of them.
Mm. He recorded massively, too. I mean, it's amazing, the scores.
And stuff with Eddie Lang is so beautiful.
Oh, yeah, that Blind Willie Dunn, huh?
Yeah.
I get a Google alert every day for Paul Butterfield, and today there's only one link, and it's for you, a concert you're playing at St. John's Church in Greenwich Village next month. The first time I saw you, Jeff, was at the Fenway Theater when Butterfield and Mike Bloomfield reunited. It was around Christmas 1970, I think, and Paul called you out. Is Jeff Muldaur in the house? And you emerged eventually and performed with him. I was about a 16-year-old, maybe 17 at the time, and it was the first time I'd seen you, but I was already deeply into Butterfield and had seen him a lot. And then you went on to...
He's a good guy to be deeply into.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you know, geez.
What was, there's photographs of you and Joe Boyd and Eric Von Schmidt and others at Newport in 65, where you look absolutely delighted beyond words at the Butterfield Band appearing there on that Friday.
Yeah, it was one of the most musically historical things that ever happened in this country. And it had nothing to do with Bob Dylan going electric.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, that was a cultural event. He had already recorded
like
a Rolling Stone anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That was nothing musically for a guy like me. I'm not into the whole pop world star thing. So the Dylan thing meant nothing to me. But to see an integrated band from Chicago play electric blues was shocking. And three of those members were three of the greatest that ever did it. Paul Butterfield, Mike Bloomfield, and Sammy Lay on drums.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys were, you know, kicking. And it wasn't just a conceptual change. These guys were good, man. Real good.
Jump, baby, everywhere. Gotta mellow down easy. You gotta mellow down easy, baby. You gotta mellow down easy, baby, before you blow your top. You gotta mellow down easy, baby, before you blow your top. You gotta move, move here. Move, move there. Move, move, baby. Move, move, baby. Everywhere. You gotta mellow down, ease, baby. You gotta mellow down, ease, baby. You gotta mellow down, ease, baby, before you blow your top. You gotta mellow down, ease, baby, before you blow your top.
All of us in Cambridge just loved it. You know, we didn't do that. We couldn't do that. We didn't think we could do it. I did it later, but we just totally appreciated it. We weren't like purists in folk music and all that crap. You know, we were already listening to B.B. King and all that stuff. We went over there to hear Hubert Sumlin that year, too. I think he was playing with...
Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, he was playing with Howlin' Wolf.
Right. You know, you're almost anticipating a thought of mine, which is you guys... I did not hew to the purist acoustic-only or country blues-only ideology.
Music.
We
listen to Greek music half the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, with Byron Leonardos, in the Club 47 when we'd close the place down at night, we're playing Greek 78s, drinking ouzo. I mean, wherever we found the music, you know, and then we got into Joseph Spence, you know, and all sorts of stuff. We played Mexican music in my house. You know, I think Joe was the same way, and Cambridge was wonderful that way. Just really explored all sorts of stuff.
Yes, I recall an interview with you, which you kind of credit Cambridge as being, more fostering of individuality.
Of course. I mean, that was part of the thing that Von Schmidt laid down pretty good, which is, let's take these beautiful things that we hear, and let's put our own heart and soul into them, not learn them rote. Now, later, I think John Hammond was the first guy we heard who actually learned how to play some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't impress us that much because we could hear the original, you know. We'd go hear Robert Johnson and go, well, it's nice that he can do that, but, you know. So when Von Schmidt would do a tune, it would be Von Schmidt, you know. Mm-hmm. And he had some soul that I liked, man, and I liked playing with him. And so that was sort of the way it was done up there, and that's the way I still do it. If I don't think I can add something or change it in a certain way to fit my own feelings, I don't do a tune. Mm-hmm. I don't do it just to learn it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have respect for the guys who've learned how all that great picking with Blind Blake and all that stuff and Blind Lemon Jefferson. It's amazing what they can do, and it has worth because it has worth in a classical sense.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're carrying on a tradition that's important, but that's not what was going on up in Cambridge at all.
Back to Newport for a minute and the Bob Dylan Going Electric. It's been my sort of contention, for what it's worth, that it was Butterfield's controversial appearance there that Friday afternoon and that disparaging introduction by Alan Lomax that really inspired Dylan to spontaneously decide to go electric that Sunday night.
I don't know, man. I'd have to ask Albert, but he isn't here.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about people don't remember this, but, well, some people must. First of all, the audience at Newport, if you ever see pictures of the audience, they're the most Tweety-looking people you've ever seen.
Sure. Yeah.
It's great. They're all wearing herringbone jackets. And everybody confuses that era with the San Francisco thing, right? And, you know, the other thing is, in those days, sound systems were terrible.
Mm.
They were self-defeating half the time.
Yeah.
And so one of the things about the quotes, Dylan going electric, that's interesting to me is I was out there listening for a little while, and it sounded like shit to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Want to bleep that word?
Yeah.
It just sounded terrible to me.
Yep.
I couldn't hear anything, but in recent years, I've heard Dylan's voice on Penny's Farm. I thought Penny's Farm was a disaster, but when I heard him, it was somehow they amplified just him on this thing,
mm-hmm.
and he was fine.
Yeah.
He was fine.
Yeah.
It's just that the overall sound with you know, they couldn't handle somebody like
Bloomfield.
Mike Bloomfield, all that note salad going on, and, you know, through the wrong amp, through the wrong mic, through the wrong everything. And I just thought the sound was pretty bad, but it sure wasn't bad for Butterfield at that workshop, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you know, people talk about this thing over and over and over again, and I just never thought it was that important. I've been interviewed on this thing many times. I'm the only guy, basically, who says he didn't particularly like the music. But when I went back and listened, I had to say to myself, wow, it's mostly about the sound. It wasn't about that they weren't playing good, you know.
I listened to like a Rolling Stone the other day. It's on a Vimeo clip, and it sounds good.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the arrangement's a little shaky, but.
Yeah. I mean, it was also musically, I wasn't going to go with him where he was going to go musically because I'm a musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very rudimentary kind of approach to, you know. When I'm in a foul mood, I do say to friends of mine that are in the singer-songwriter world, say, if you're so good at writing words, why don't you just write poetry? You know, because the music, I'm a musician, man. I need to hear something going on that interests me, you know.
Well,
and I don't really listen to words very well.
Yeah. Bloomfield always said he couldn't believe how careless, thoughtless, unconcerned Bob seemed to be with the music.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
Yeah.
So I didn't go. I didn't take the journey. Sorry.
Well, that's certainly.
But I'll tell you, when he did "Hard Rain's Gonna Fall" at the workshop, that was one of the most striking things I've ever heard in my life.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. That thing is an opus. That thing's it's an anthem, and he was great. He was great.
Have you heard Bill Frisell play it?
Nope.
Yeah, it's worth a listen.
I'd like to.
Yeah. It's on one of Bill's Nonesuch recordings. So how did you connect or reconnect with Butterfield around Better Days?
That just happened because I moved a band after the Jug Band broke up. We made one album up in Cambridge called Pottery Pie. That's where that Brazil thing came from.
Yeah, and that beautiful Yaz banner on the cover. Huh? Carl Yastrzemski?
Oh, yeah.
Remember that album cover?
It's the best. You know what? You know, Charlie Frizzell took that picture, and what we did was, We left the front door open to our apartment, said, come in the morning and wake us up so you'll get that look. And so it let us make a cup of tea, but that was it. Boom. The shots started coming, and, you know, we had the usual things hanging around. We didn't prop it too much. You know, that's just the way the bed looked. I love that cover.
But, you know, when I saw the Yaz banner, of course, I loved it at the time, but it's went out 50 years since the impossible dream season of the Red Sox. Were you caught up in that at the time?
I went to two of the series games in 67. Manny Greenhill had tickets for me.
Cool.
And they won both of those games.
Right.
And I couldn't go to the third one. Mm-hmm. And that's when they lost. Yeah. So I was the good luck charm, but they did, you know.
So you
and they sure waited a long time, didn't they?
Yeah, sure enough. Yep. But they've done it. Yep.
They have.
Yep. You made Pottery
Pie. I remember Bob Jones. You know who that is?
Yeah, I know who you mean. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, his mother was like 101 or something, and it was one of these years. Maybe it was 80. That wasn't 86. There was a World Series. Was that 86? I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that was the World Series against the Mets.
Well, there was one year where she said to Bob, said, because she was going to be sent out to the pitcher's mound on a red carpet if they won, because she was at the first one they won.
Oh, 1918, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
So she was like royalty.
Right.
And she just said, Bob, they better win it this year. I don't know how much longer I can hang on here. But they didn't.
Right. Well, I was delighted my father lived long enough to see them win two of them.
Yeah, good.
You were in Cambridge. You made Pottery Pie. Did you move to Woodstock?
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
And then I called Albert. He was our manager.
Oh, okay.
You know, and then felt, how about I move this band down to Woodstock?
It's all small town talk. You know how people are. They can't stand to see other people doing what they like to do. It's small town talk. Don't you pay no mind. Those same people try and do it every time. You can't believe in anything you hear.
if you're gonna believe in anyone, darling, believe in me. It's small town talk, it's a well-known fact. You might never know how one might react to what you're thinking.
And during that period, I was hanging with Butterfield. You know, we drank in the same bars and did the same crazy things. And little by little, that was what was going on around there. And Albert got the idea to get, you know, he knew that nothing was going on with my band, but he knew there was good people in it. So he got me and Amos and and Paul. And we started to peck away at an album. We got Christopher Parker on drums. He was a young kid then.
Who knew Ronnie Barron? How did Ronnie
Barron? Well, that was Albert's idea.
Oh.
That's crazy, man. Because Ronnie, I mean, Albert, that was his idea. I would have never done it, but it worked out great. And he was just this crazy guy from Algiers, which is New Orleans across the river, and he was a friend of Mac Rebinac's, Dr. John. And he was going to be Dr. John because they were childhood friends.
All right. Okay.
Yep. Him and Mac.
Yep.
And they had decided to create this character based on this voodoo guy in the 19th century or something named Dr. John.
Mm-hmm.
But then Ronnie got this gig with Louis Prima, and he went out on the road, and Mac took the Dr. John name. And I don't know, but Ronnie came up, and he was completely different than we were, and for some reason, it just worked. We ended up being really good friends, and it was a great group, man. Better days, Paul Butterfield, man.
Fantastic. Yeah. When I saw Butter and Bloomfield there at the Fenway Theater, Billy Mundy was on drums.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I think of it. Yeah. That weekend.
Well, he was a sweet guy. There's a lot of past tense now going on when you're talking about my friends.
Absolutely, yeah. You tell a story, I read it in Mike Zwerin's column years ago about...
If it's Mike Zwerin's column, it probably was wrong.
I think I've heard you reiterate it, though, and it has to do with...
That guy, I couldn't believe it. I would say something, and then he would say it back to me, and he would have it all wrong. He interviewed me in Paris.
Yep.
His claim to fame was he snuck onto a Miles Davis recording as a trombonist, I think.
Yeah, he played on
Birth
of the Cool.
And he became this big shot writer, but God almighty, excuse me, I shouldn't say things like this. Okay, what were you saying?
He played like bass trombone on one of the Birth of the Cool sessions with Miles when he was about 18. You told a story about an encounter with Cannonball Adderley, and today is Cannonball's birthday anniversary, so... What better opportunity to reiterate that story about Cannonball and Butter and you and
well, we were, you know, a lot of time has passed. I moved back to the Woodstock area now, and I realized I left there 43 years ago.
Mm.
So people don't know how big a deal Paul Butterfield was. But we were in Cleveland, and Weather Report was opening for us.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Joe Zawinul.
And when we played Las Vegas, you know, the Doobie Brothers opened for us. When we played Kansas City, Dr. John opened for us. You know, Paul was a big star.
Sure.
Anyway, Cannonball and his brother were in town, and they were playing a jazz club. And then we were staying in the same hotel, and for some reason I ended up in Cannonball's room with Butter. And lollygagging and all that. And Cannonball trying to get Paul to say he'd come down and sit in at the club.
Oh, okay.
And Paul said, I got to get some cigarettes, and he left the room. And Cannonball sort of leaned towards me from maybe the edge of the bed or whatever, and said, do you know who the hell you're playing with? Do you know how good Paul Butterfield is? That was Cannonball Adderley. And I at the time, I sort of didn't.
Wow.
I knew he was great, but it took me a little while to add up what he was doing. I didn't have an understanding of rhythm sections yet. You know, don't forget, I came out of Cambridge, Mass. Yeah. Folk guy. Yeah. Razzmatazz jug band guy. So by the time I left that band, I knew how good he was. And then in later years, it's even more striking. He's the kind of guy, no matter what band was playing, if he decided to sit in and they were playing a groove, he could come up on that stage, think about it for 2 seconds and hit three notes. And those three notes would dictate how that groove could be better.
Mm.
He was just a rhythmic genius.
Absolutely.
Then he'd come up, bah, bah, bah. Mm-hmm. Also, what was that?
Mm.
And then, you know, that adds to the to the texture of this thing.
Mm.
He just had it. And he had it forever. A friend of mine gave me a tape he made of him in 64 in his apartment.
Mm-hmm.
This artist named Bruce Conner.
Mm.
And he taped Paul in his apartment on his woolen sack or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great.
Mm.
He was great. You know,
there's a tape
before
circuit.
Newport and everything.
Tape circulating right now of Butter and Janis Joplin at Cambridge Rindge and Latin in the high school auditorium, and he opened because it was a different story only months earlier where he was headlining in San Francisco and Cream and Jefferson Airplane and everybody were on the undercard. But anyway, he sits in with Janis, and my God, you know, like you just said, the three notes, you can almost—it's almost like you're in the room. The place becomes electric. Mm-hmm. With Paul's appearance. And
he's fabulous. You know, like I say, this is sort of maybe a bit too much, but I really believe it's true. The people who I've played with over my career, who I've interacted with, Queskin and with Amos Garrett and with Maria, you know,
mm-hmm.
and with various groups I've been in, they really needed me. I had skills that they needed.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I played with Butterfield. I don't think he needed me that much. He was a monster, man.
Yeah.
You know, I brought a little something to it,
but
only a little.
Hmm.
He was that good, man.
Hmm. Did some great singing with him. Please
send
me someone to love.
Well, I'm lucky to have a voice.
Yeah.
And that's why Albert wanted to do that, because I could sing in a whole different way than he could.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven, please. Send all mankind understanding and peace of mind. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Someone to love. Show the world how to get along. Peace will enter when hate is gone. And if it's not asking too much, send me someone to love. Ooh.
And I think the first album is pretty damn good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I enjoyed it, but you know what happened. The nasty ways took over.
Mm.
And so I had to get out of there.
I read a quote from you in that book about Woodstock. You said something like it was about musical evolution and character devolution.
Well, that guy has a tendency to write his own words. I would never say those words, but I know what he means, and I probably said something very much like it.
I see.
I haven't read the book because they say it's very...
it's a bit of a scandal. It's kind of a scandal sheet.
Yeah. I don't need that.
I have to say it's...
Unfortunately, I'm part of the scandals, evidently.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I got up to Martha's Vineyard and got away from things, but I took myself with me, so the devolution continued.
I know that expression. Yeah. I took myself with me. Yeah.
So I got off a couple more albums for Warner Brothers. I had a wonderful album that Joe Boyd produced called Jeff Mulder's One, Having a Wonderful Time.
Mm.
And then did some things for Flying Fish with Amos. And mm-hmm. Another one for Joe's label. And we got a lot of work done that back then. You know?
Yeah. But you took a pretty long break from performance and touring. And
right. In 84, I went into the repair shop. And at that point, I said, you know, I don't want to hang out with these unruly musicians. So I didn't do anything for like 14, 15 years.
Wow. Oh.
You know, I had some jobs, and then I ended up in Detroit working in the steel industry and automating steel processing. And I made a little money and wore fancy suits and stuff.
Mm.
And then this guy, Bob Neuwirth, came to town, a friend of mine from the old days.
Yeah. Huh.
And he was recording Patti Smith, and he came up to my office with, like, programmers and consultants and stuff. And he said, hey, man, have you been listening to the radio? I said, well, I listen to the classical station, Bob. I said, well, are you listening to any of the music going on? Well, yeah, I hear some of the music going on. He said, you hearing anything like maybe sounds like you?
Mm-hmm.
No, not really, Bob. No. This was so good. He said, well, this work you're doing in Detroit, do you think somebody else could do this? I said, well, not as good as I do it, Bob, but maybe you're right. Maybe someone else could do this. And he said, well, I'm going to Italy on a tour. You want to join me?
Mm.
And I, for some reason, I said, yes. So I went off to Italy, and they didn't even like me. I couldn't believe it.
Did they like Bob?
Yeah, because, you know, if you wear a cowboy hat or you put on boots, man, that's all they were interested in, northern Italy. But and the fact that he was Dylan's right-hand man. I mean,
sure.
You don't have to do anything after that.
Right.
But down in Sicily, that's where they dug me. So I went, well, these are real Italians down here.
Right.
Screw those. Screw the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. So anyway, I still got hooked. I worked up Wild Axe Moan there. And I started working on the guitar, and I went, you know what? I don't care if anybody likes me or not. I'm coming back. Mm-hmm. So I started making an album called The Secret Handshake,
sure.
and on, you know, on my own dough. And then those wonderful people at High Tone picked up on it. You know, other people didn't, but Larry Slovin and those guys, they heard that stuff, and they went, man, come on a label. And they were very nice. You know, made a couple of nice albums. And that got me going.
So you had to shop that around a bit, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you've heard this. Everyone's heard this story about books and all sorts of stuff, you know. You know, one of the things I think of why I was so highly acclaimed was because I still used 16-track, you know, 30 IPS tape. And everybody had already gone digital, and everything was sounding tinny, and they didn't have the sampling rates they have now. And I just made a fat old record the way I used to make a fat old record, you know. And it sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
Still does.
Do you know Larry Rivers?
Well, you can't know him now. He's not
well
gone. But I didn't know him. My friend in Detroit, who lured me into Detroit in the first place, I did a little work at his place, but I moved on to somewhere else. But he knew Larry Rivers because his mother was the West Coast, or excuse me, the Midwest gallery for all the New York artists of the 40s and 50s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he knew them all.
Yeah.
And when it was time to do the cover for Password, the second album I did for High Tone, I got to go into New York with him and go up to Larry's studio, and Larry did a portrait. He was incredible. He's a wonderful artist.
Mm-hmm. Played tenor sax.
And a crazy guy.
Crazy guy, yeah.
I mean, so crazy, man. Yeah. He wanted to play saxophone with me, and I said, look, I'm here to get an album cover done.
But
then he's taking pictures and looking around and putting things behind me, and everything. He says, oh, sorry. Puts everything down, goes over to the television set, and watches Judge Judy for a half an hour.
Wow.
And so Roger and I go over to the kitchen and make a little coffee and go, that's Larry, you know. And then he ends the show and comes back and starts doing more.
Huh.
He was nuts, man. Yeah. But so talented. Mm-hmm. Such a great draw. He could draw. He could draw.
Yeah, it's a great album cover. And he wrote an amazing memoir with a very a very catchy name, kind of a double entendre, and I can't think of it at the moment. But
something like I Didn't Do It. Or
It wasn't me or something along those lines. But
well, yeah, quite a life.
Right.
I love getting artists to do covers. Bruce Conner did a cover when I produced the Borneo Horns with Lenny Pickett's album.
Mm.
And, of course, Von Schmidt. But then later, Ed Ruscha did a cover for us for the Texas Sheiks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it's really nice to, you know, artists like good music, and sometimes you can get them to do you a favor.
All right. Well, Jeff Muldaur, it has really been a pleasure to speak with you. And we have a little traffic jam occurring here in our studio. So I'm going to have to bid you adieu for now. And thank you so much for the time this morning. And enjoy Pomfret
well,
tonight.
Thank you.
We'll see you in Northampton.
I will.
Tomorrow
night. I'm going bird watching right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow, tomorrow
That's
night.
That's another subject. Okay, man. Good talk to you.
Okay, Jeff. Likewise. Yep.
Life will be all over, and our pilgrimage will end. Soon we'll take our heavenly journey, be at home again with friends. Heaven's gates are standing over, waiting for our entrance there. Some sweet day we're going over, all the beauties there to share. Just a little while to stay here, just a little while to just a little while to linger in the path that's always straight. Just a little more of heart trouble in this low and earthly state, then we'll enter heaven's portal.